Hi, Caitlin, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
Thanks for meeting with me. Hope your day is going well. How are you?
Yes, I'm good. Sorry I'm late. I'm
No, it's.
also the girls' basketball manager, so they just finished their practice.
Oh, yeah, no, it's no worries. The life of a college student, I totally understand.
Yeah.
But just to get started, in setting some norms for this interview will be recorded for future use. And after our time together, I'll send you the recording file. And if there's any material that you'd like omitted from the final version, just let me know and that request will be met. And of course, given the Zoom platform, if you need to take a break for water, use the bathroom, just let me know. We can pause the recording. And if it's okay with you, I'll remain unmuted for the duration of the interview, and I'll just type some notes as we talk. And thank you for meeting with me again. Are there any questions?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Oh, and I didn't say this. This interview will be preserved in the Duke University Ar Archive of Youth Activists. The class I'm in, Youth Movement Since 2010. We're trying to focus on this idea of creating an archive that holds youth activists that aren't on like main media platforms that we see nationally. So yeah, that's the goal of the project. And so just to start off, if you could state your name, your age, and where you currently work.
Okay, so my name is Caitlin Leggett. Some people also know me by Skip. I'm 21 and I currently work for NPR's WNC Radio and I intern at WHIG TV on North Carolina Wesleyan College's campus.
Okay, awesome. So when did your activism start?
That's a good question. I guess we can say I started activism pretty young. I just didn't know it was activism.
Right.
It was kind of just me recording my experiences by way of whatever method I had at the time. So writing was always kind of my outlet. So probably I didn't realize it was really activism until probably 2020, really.
Yeah.
A lot of the things that I wrote and the things that I published and put out there was stuff that I had from back when I was in high school, and I'm a senior in college now, so none of it was new, but it was still relevant. So definitely pretty young. Can't give an exact age, but pretty young.
Yeah. So let's go back to that piece of 2020. 2020 was a crazy year. COVID, Black Lives Matter, the movement for Black Lives, presidential election, that was all 2020. It's crazy to think back to that was like 2020. If you could tell me like a phrase or two just about like what did your life look like in 2020?
My life in 2020.
Or maybe just like what was one of the most like pivot, the most like important parts of your life in 2020?
I think, let's see. 2020 was the year that I actually published my book. And I don't know, it seemed small compared to everything that was going on, but my book encompassed the experiences that I'd had since I started writing, so maybe middle school. And with everything that was going on, there was so much trauma. That was literally all I saw. And my family, we're a family that watches the news a lot. So anytime I turned around, there was a lot of trauma. And my book encompasses the things that I experienced, but the things that I'm aware that a lot of other people experience. And sometimes that trauma isn't always something that we know how to validate. In the news, we saw a lot of death, a lot of black and brown death, but sometimes it's just as simple as a little kid calling you an Oreo. There are things that we don't recognize, things just everyday experiences, microaggressions, everything, things that we don't recognize, all put together in the experiences of my life. And with the pandemic, everyone being forced to sit and watch the plight that Black people deal with on a daily basis, I felt like, again, most of my writings was, they were things that were from years prior. They weren't, I think I might have actually written one poem in 2020 in the entirety of it. And I think my book has 40 in it. So I think with all the time for people to sit and just watch what was happening, I felt like this was a good way to say, one, to say that there are people like me and this is for you. I hear you. I see you. We hear. But there are people who don't understand. There are people who don't have to deal with these things, who don't have to experience this. And this is also for you because we know what we go through. Right. You don't. And it was also just, it had been a personal goal of mine. And I think, again, with seeing a lot of trauma, and that's not to say that my book doesn't have trauma in it, it does, but that was a way for me to get my trauma out. And putting it all together was really just kind of a little, it was a little piece of Black joy in all that we were looking at that year. So
Yeah, your book, Mad Black Women or Woman, Diaries on the Intersectionality of a Black Woman. I mean, that title alone makes me want to read. 2020 was traumatic, and having a book, a resource where like we can read about experiences that Black women go through is so vital, especially in a year like 2020. Could you tell me a little bit about like where you grew up, what your environment was like? How did it allow your activism to grow?
Right. So I'm from Durham, North Carolina, the East. I guess where I grew up, usually when I tell people from Durham, they go, Durham, like, it's always kind of a, people turn their nose up at it. You have Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill of the three. Durham is kind of like, you know, it's a little bit of the trenches. I grew up right down the street from my high school, a park, and two hoods. So I want to say that I have a diverse experience, not culturally diverse, but more so socially diverse. I'm aware that I didn't grow up in the like nicest of neighborhoods and, you know, richest of parts of town. But I know that they exist in Durham and I've seen them before. Especially being an athlete, I play volleyball. Volleyball is a white sport. That's all I see. I didn't really start seeing Black girls in my sport until I want to say about high school. I know everybody in my neighborhood. I know everybody in my church. Durham is one of those places where you, if you don't know nobody, you're going to know somebody who knows somebody who knows who you are.
Right.
It's a city, but it's not nothing huge. I think my environment, I'm very proud of being from Durham. Like I can't stay there, but I'm very proud of where I'm from. Like I have 919s had it on me. Like that's really my heart. But the city can definitely be brutal. I think I had a lot of experiences that I didn't know were not normal until I got away from it. I buried a lot of classmates. I've been in a lot of situations that I probably shouldn't have, and that I, again, things I thought were normal that were not normal. But I don't know, at the end of the day, like my city stamped me, like I'm proud of where I'm from. You know, it is what it is. Like, I don't have no regrets being from my city.
So do you think being surrounded by, you know, people who look like you at a young age and throughout your life, what was the power of being around people who look like you, going to school with people who look like you, but then of course like the opposition in college, like how did you deal with that? Because you attend a PWI, right?
Well, or technically, I mean, Wesleyan is 70% Black, so
majority. It's not HBCU. So
yeah, definitely not.
Yeah.
I think I definitely did grow up in a Black college town. And it's crazy. I was just talking about this today, how like that was one thing that I actually, you know, I never really had any regrets about going to PWIs for college, because being at an HBCU was my entire existence up until going to college. And it was never, I don't want to go to an HBCU. I never got any money from HBCUs. I would have went if they would have threw me some bread, but yeah, you know, it happens. I think my freshman year, I went to a school in Boston called Clark University, and that was my first culture shock. And when I say culture shock, I mean, of course, nothing but white people, but the Black people that were there were not solely Black. They were immigrants. They were Caribbean. They were African. They were Puerto Rican. They were Panamanian. They were anything but just Black. And coming from the South, we don't, a lot of us don't really identify. We don't know too much about our heritage. We don't know where we're from. I just know I'm Black. I knew Black, white, Hispanic. That was really about it. And up there, nobody is what they look like. You have white passing people who are Puerto Rican, who speak, whose first language is completely Spanish. You have dark skinned, kinky haired girls whose first language is Spanish or French or German. Like, it's things that I've never seen before. So I was very appreciative of that experience, because I don't think I would have gotten that anywhere here in the South. But one thing about being up there was the racism is very covert versus here is very overt. I see your Confederate flag. I see your Blue Lives Matter. I see all of that, and you're proud about it. That's fine. So I know where to keep you. Up there, hey, can you come take this picture with me? And then I hear statements, and I hear whispers. I hear things like that. So very, very different experience. I think I do well in any space. I understand how to code switch. I understand that I don't need to code switch, but I understand how to. I think for me, my decision was really all about the money and what would put me in the best position, definitely. But transferring out of that environment, because honestly, it had a lot to do with me being alone. I became very introverted there because, one, it's cold. I don't do the cold. Two, I was by myself in Boston. I don't have no family out there. And I grown up in a very like family church centered, like oriented environment. Like, I wasn't used to that. And then even when there were people who looked like me, they weren't really like me. And so coming back, I knew I wanted to come back to the South. Didn't really care where. My mom kind of had a stipulation: if you're transferring back in, you have to come back in state, no tuition. And I knew the coach at Wesleyan. And I will say, because Wesleyan is predominantly athletes, that's why I say it's you know, it's not a PWI, but it's definitely not an HBCU. But honestly, like, everybody that's here is Black because they play a sport. And one thing that I had heavy on my agenda when I got here, and one thing that I made sure, is that my face is all over this campus, but not because I'm an athlete, because I'm a part of clubs, because I do the news here, because I get academic awards. Like, you're going to see me outside of what y'all brought me here for. Because there are a lot of students here who are a lot more than that, but you would never know, because when you look at the Honors College, you might see a couple of Black and brown faces.
Wow. In a school that's 70% Black.
In a school that's 70% Black, you look at your administration, you see a couple of Black and brown faces in a school that's 70% Black. So I think when it comes to culture wise, I mean, Rocky Mount is like much of North Carolina. It's just like to the max. So, I mean, you have all your, you know, country, whatever, in North Carolina, and Rocky Mount looks just like that. But then you have your Black folk, you have, you know, your downtown, your urban areas, all of that. So I don't think it wasn't a huge adjustment for me being from Durham to Rocky Mount, but it was a shift between going to Boston and spending that year there.
Interesting. So it's you're a busy woman. You do volleyball, you're in clubs, you're an activist. That's a lot of stuff. Being a freshman, I don't know how you do it. I'm barely scratching the surface.
Okay.
How do you balance it all? Like, how do you ever have to prioritize things over the other? How do you balance it?
I don't. I'm not even gonna lie to you. Especially lately with me being a senior, I've stretched myself completely thin. But in the beginning, I mean, in high school, that's just how I operated. Like, you know, it's like you could be busy in high school and it was nothing. Mm-hmm. College is different. You have to manage your time. And I think for me, for one, I'm big on like, just like tangible wise, I'm big on lists, calendars. Like my room is filled. I have a to-do list on every single piece of paper that I have in my room. I have to see it over and over because I'm really one of those out of sight, out of mind people. I have a calendar for volleyball. I have a calendar for women's basketball, for work. I just have something for everything. I'm not the most organized person. I'm bad with planners, but I think one thing that helped me balance was that I learned that it was okay to fail. Like, it's okay. I double book myself all the time. I will literally, like, this right here, I literally knew practice was going to end at 6 and that this started at 6 and that I had 5 minutes to get home and throw a shirt on. Like, I understand that it's okay to fail. Like, it happens. And that's what you learn from. I lift, I power lift, and a good day is when you fail. When I don't reach a PR, when my muscles are tight, like a good day is when I fail, because I know, okay, this is my benchmark and I have to push past this. So I think allowing myself to fail sometimes and understanding that, like, even though I try to do it all, I don't have to.
Right.
And I pile my plate mountains high, but it's okay if I don't get it all done. And I think also asking for help. Before college, I didn't like asking for help, but I have a huge, like, supportive community behind me. Like, even that was one thing, like, when I transferred in, I didn't know what it was like to have a coach who really supported me. Like, I mean, really supported me. She watches my interviews on her downtime. She comes to my events. She understands, you know, yeah, I'm an athlete, but I have a lot of ahead of me. Like, I have a bright future. And as bad as I want to play volleyball for the rest of my life, I have to set myself up for something great. And she's there for that. I have best friends. I have mentors. You know, like, it really does take a village. And sometimes that's like what I need, even if it's not, you know, something physical or tangible. It's something like I just need someone to lean on. Yeah. So I really wouldn't say that I ever do balance. It's always like something always tips the scale. I'm always forgetting something, running to something. But I mean, I don't know. I kind of wouldn't have it any other way. That's just how I function in chaos. Like, seeing 1,000 things on my schedule, like, it's daunting sometimes, but I'm used to it. And that's just how I operate. Like, I know that there are times that I have to multitask. When I'm at work, I'm almost always doing homework. Like, because that's really the only time I ever have. And when I come home, I remember someone saying something like, you know, like, there's a time for everything. So when I'm in that space, like, I utilize it to the fullest of my potential. So when I'm at work, I get my work done and then I do my homework. But when I'm at home, like, I'm not going to, you know how some people will work off the clock and off.
No.
See, me, I'm gonna go to sleep. I'm not gonna close you. I'm taking a nap.
Right.
But I do understand, you know, I have a lot to do, but yeah, just kind of doing everything when you have the time to do it. Creating the space for those things, but also creating the space for things that you like, because you will burn yourself out. Like, just as much as I get stuff done, I'd be out. I'd be in the streets. Right. I do.
You got to.
But, like, I need balance. Like, that's probably the only balance I have, is my work and my play life. But yeah, everything else is just, some stuff you weighted down, some stuff don't.
Yeah. I want to go back to that idea of like failures, but like when you were describing it, it was small in terms of small, like subtle failures as opposed mm-hmm. to like life-changing failures. Mm-hmm. Which, like, I think when we hear that term failure, it's like always a negative connotation as opposed to like what you were saying, which is like just a barrier to go past, like just another mm-hmm. mark. How does that translate into your activism?
I think failure in that matter is really, it's really a norm, I think, because a lot has been done since civil rights, since even past mm-hmm. that, a lot has been done, but there's also a long ways to go. So I think failure, again, is a benchmark, but I think failure in that sense is knowing that you might not be failing because of you. You might be failing because the system was not built for you. The system was meant for you to fail. So you failing is not always really a failure on your part. You might be succeeding, but the system right. was built for you to be down. So if you're not coming up, it's not on you all the time. Mm-hmm. It's how things were built. I think one thing that I thought about a lot with this movement was that it kind of bothered me that we didn't have a solidified kind of leader or mm-hmm. leaders. When you look back in history, people rally behind ideals, yes, mm-hmm. but they love to see a face
yeah.
on that ideal. And the faces that we saw were dead bodies. We didn't see any living. Mm. Now, I don't want to say any. We didn't have a cohesive, a person to rally behind, because there were so many. Like, you know, there were protests in every city. Right. There were yeah. people were fighting for different things that were all under the same umbrella, but there was no one person, there was no two people right. For people to really follow behind. And I think that was one thing that I always felt like would be a failure, because if you look in history, that's just how we've operated.
Yeah.
And I think that also makes it easier for people to understand. You know, like you think of MLK, you think of nonviolence and love, and, you know, spiritualism and all of that. And you think of Malcolm X and you think of, you know, hardcore, more stick it to the man type things. But people had options. They had, I understand I'm fighting for the same cause, but how I want to fight. Here are these two ways to choose from. And without that centralized face or those centralized faces, it was a lot of, I don't want to say work for nothing, but ultimately, like, that's what I was most afraid that it would come to. And I also didn't want a movement to be confused with a trend.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
I also felt like that was another big failure, mm-hmm. was that trends die off.
Like that black square kind of mm-hmm. right after with George Floyd's death, I'm pretty sure, right? Mm-hmm. The black square that everyone was posting on Instagram and Twitter in solidarity. And then you'd look the next month, it was in their archive or off their Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Trends
die. Yeah.
And so I have a question about that piece about like seeing faces. I totally mm-hmm. agree with like people can agree on the same ideas, but it's hard sometimes to unite when you don't have a person to unite with. Like
mm-hmm.
people, you know, had kings and they followed them. People had Martin Luther King and they followed him. Malcolm X, they followed him. But also like the movement, the civil rights movement, was a lot of it was founded upon religion and like mm-hmm. cohesiveness within like believing in God and believing the like ideals of God. And mm-hmm. here we have BLM that's like, or the movement for Black Lives that's so far away from that, like, which isn't a bad thing. It's just like different. Right. But mm-hmm. what do we unite with besides like our shared oppression? Like, and is that enough to like really progress the movement?
And I think like that's what I think of when I say like there were no living faces, there were dead bodies. And like, honestly, like one of my biggest fears, like putting all this aside, one of my biggest fears is that I know when I die, like I'm eventually going to be forgotten. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm going to stay on someone's mind every now and then, but eventually I'm going to be forgotten. We have all of these faces who are, yes, they're names that are worldwide now, but eventually they're going to be forgotten. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't as if they were ever, these were people. These weren't, most of them were not activists. They were just regular people living their lives who they didn't give up their lives. Their lives were taken for them.
Yeah.
We put their face on this movement. They don't know that. Mm-hmm. They have no idea. Or they do, looking down, unable to do anything. So I think rallying around trauma sometimes it's something that'll bring people together. It's something that people can relate to, but what are you looking forward to?
Yeah.
What is coming out of this trauma? Hmm. And I think that was something that a lot of people were missing. And again, like, you know, everybody has their different soapbox. Some people, you know, wanted less disparity within the medical community. Mm-hmm. Some people wanted
school reform, the
disproportionate amount of Black people to stop being arrested. Yeah. You know, so there were different hills for people to die on. And mm-hmm. all of them are equally as important. But because there was no real unity. Mm-hmm. And not to say, you know, people marched, people did all that they could, but there was no real sense of this is what we're coming together for. This is what we're trying to accomplish. Because I think a lot of us don't know. We want change, but we don't know what change will ever look like. Mm-hmm. Like we wouldn't know how to grasp the idea of real change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What do you think would have kind of not, what's the wording? How do you think the protests could have changed to focus on one idea? Because some people might say they focused on police brutality, but police brutality is also a really big umbrella too. What changes in that period where people were marching in every city, rallying under, you know, deceased people's names, what change do you think could have occurred if, you know, their tactics would have changed?
So, I mean, personally, I think the system has to be completely dismantled, but...
Police or the system as in the government?
The system as in the government, as in the entire thing. But I think a more tangible thing to do would be to start at the top. So you have all of these government officials, people in office who, these were the same people who 60, 70 years ago were telling us to go to the back of the bus.
Mm.
So how do you expect these people who had these ideals, these people, the very people you're marching against who are holding these ideals to make decisions in favor of us? That's not what they were put there for. The right. system put them there to make decisions against us. And that's what they believe. So there's no reason for them to do anything else. They're doing their jobs. You start at the top. You dismantle these politicians, the government officials who hold these ideals, who are upholding the things that the government has put in place, all of these things that work against us. And you get, even if you can't get them out,
mm-hmm.
you make it work in your favor.
Mm.
Because I don't think I don't think a system like this can be reformed. Mm-hmm. You can make it work in your favor, but it can't be reformed. Right. It was quite literally built to put us down. So there's no reforming that. It's doing its job.
Yeah.
There's never been a time where the system wasn't doing its job, however unfair it may be. You start at the top and then things trickle down. Mm-hmm. Again, it's a marathon type, slow and steady change. Things that then become norms, things that become legislation, things that begin to work in our favor, and you go down from there.
So the key change would be voting, or like voting for people who have the same ideals as you?
You know, I wish that was it. I do.
Yeah.
I definitely, you know, I'm always going to vote, but I do understand how...
It's lost for hope.
Yeah, I understand. I will never fight anybody on their heel of I don't vote.
Mm-hmm.
I get what you're saying, but it would be hypocritical of me to not do everything within my power just because I feel like it's not going to help. I'm pretty sure there were a lot of people 60, 70 years ago who thought them hopping in that crowd of people wasn't going to help.
Mm.
Yet here we are. Mm. So I think it has to be more radical than that. I think it's literally taking people out of office. Yeah, it's literally taking people out of office, because there haven't been any successful revolutions that weren't radicalized. And I understand that everybody, you know, everybody sees it differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I get the consequences that do come with a radical type of revolution. But I don't know, maybe it's the college student in me, maybe it's because I'm young, but from my understanding,
change young people. So yeah, you're not crazy.
I that's my understanding, that there's no easy way to do it.
Do you think like that, like piece of like easy, being in Gen Z, both of us, like easy is work for some of the people in our generation, you know? So it's like, it's a lot of things, I think, as you said, working against the movement, because it seems as though the generation Gen Z, like the only people really like making change are seen as radical, when like that change isn't even radical in terms of like the past 50 years. Mm-hmm. So it's like, even if we think we're all on one accord, I don't think we ever all will be.
No.
So that's, yeah, it's like,
it's, I think it's going to be an age old debate, but I think there will be change, simply because we have a world full of pandemic babies now.
Mm-hmm.
And these pandemic babies are different. And, you know, a lot of them, they're going to have completely different experiences than us and those before us.
Mm-hmm.
And my hope is that with the things that they experience,
mm-hmm.
I hope they're more educated, and they understand how to work within a system like that in mm-hmm. their favor. I think, you know, there's been levels, and within like each generation has worked within their system levels. But I think we have this age of technology, mm-hmm. crazy technology, and this age of people like us, our mm-hmm. age, getting rich,
yeah,
becoming in positions of power off of nothing.
Right.
And I think maybe currently right now we don't exactly know what to do with it, but as we get older, we'll learn. Right. And we'll hopefully, you know, be in those positions of power and those positions where you, those positions where you have these people who don't actually agree with things like Black Lives Matter and all of that, who perpetuate the system that they're upholding. So they age out, you know, and we get in. And so then we have this whole younger generation who watched all of this, who was inside for all of it. They couldn't go nowhere. So they know, they understand. They might not have experienced it, but they understand. And hopefully it won't be so far removed. Because, you know, we sometimes we look at the civil rights movement like, oh, that was umpteen years ago. No, I still got aunts, great aunts, great, great aunts who are alive. So I think, you know, they'll be the ones who say, hey, I want this, and this to happen within this office. And these people are rallying behind me. And we've all been inside together. So we know how to unify.
Right.
And we're coming to take it. So yeah, you know, you can only hope.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. What question do I want to summary? What activists do you look up to the most?
The most?
And once again, the people beside me are being really loud. I'm going to go ask them to please be quiet.
Okay.
So sorry about that.
No, you're fine. The most. I think.
Or if you knew how to do a top three, maybe that's easier.
I mean, I definitely have a lot that I looked up to, but I think it's funny because I feel like a lot of activists don't really label themselves as activists. They're kind of within their field and they happen to talk about that field. And I think definitely Maya Angelou. You know, I don't think I've ever heard her like label herself an activist, but I always loved her story more so. How she at one point was a prostitute, at one point she was a pimp, and now she's a world-renowned poet who went down in history.
Right.
And I think it's always been her story for me. Like, you know, I think a big part of me being so accepted in all of the spaces that I thrive in is because they see like one part of me. You know, if I'm around my teammates, they love me because I have a bubbly personality. If I'm around I don't know, like if I'm in the hood, like they love me because I have a sweet face, you know, like there's something that everybody enjoys, but it's, you know, not the full thing. Like if I was to go in, you know, this white space and start throwing ass, like but she's all the same person, you know, like I'm not just one person, I'm multifaceted. And I think that's my favorite thing about her, is that you're able to do that as a Black woman. You're able to exist in all of these different spaces and still, in her words, still I rise, like quite literally. I think I'm a big fan of, again, a lot of people I'm thinking of, I feel like they wouldn't label themselves activists, but Phyllis Wheatley. This was pre civil rights, all of that. But she was a writer who actually, she wrote for Thomas Jefferson. She wrote a piece that was published, And what the white people was, they went crazy. They was like, I know this little black girl didn't. I know. And nobody could believe that she could be that well-spoken and that educated within that time and thrive the way that she did. So yeah, I'll put her up there. In today's time, I'm thinking like recently. I don't know. I don't think I have like one specific that I pattern myself after, nor do I think like, I don't think I ever really think of myself as an activist. I think that's something that it's always, it's usually a label that's placed on me by other people. I think sometimes it's just like me being me. And right. I guess sometimes that just comes out. Yeah.
That's a great, two great answers. Talking about this idea of being able to communicate and take your education to the next level, how has your role as a journalist influenced your activism?
I think my role as a journalist actually kind of, it makes me consider ethical and moral obligations more than anything. Because when I write poetry and I write prose and, you know, post and all of these things, I'm writing for the sake of getting my emotions out, for the sake of easing my mind. But when I'm writing a story, I have to be conscious that these are other people's truths. And I don't want to misconstrue. I don't want to misquote. I don't want to take anyone's truth away from them and make it something that it's not. And honestly, I think that's one thing like that I contemplate even now as I'm like applying to jobs and master's programs, all of this, whether I actually want to go into journalism or I want to go into sports journalism, because I have a lot of issues with the ethics of being a journalist. I actually really hate, like, my pet peeve is when I see a camera in someone's face and they're bawling crying and they're trying to explain, you know, what happened. And I just, me as a person, if you walk up to me with a camera and I'm crying, I'm a dead kid. Because why would you do that? You see I'm having a moment, like, and like, I understand, you know, we resonate with visuals and all of this. And, you know, some people genuinely want to get their story out there and that just happens. I get that. I don't know. I just have my ethical and moral issues with it. So I think being a journalist and all of this was making sure to tell other people's truth in a manner that there was their truth, not to make it my own truth, because it's not in that moment. It's not about me, or even the things that I have to say, again, are minuscule into what I'm writing about because it's their truth. So I think it enlisted a lot of careful writing, a lot of diverse eyes reading my work. But then I did have times where, you know, it was my truth. I was writing about things that I understood that were relative to me, and I was able to put my voice in there. And more specifically to writing as a journalist, I try to take very good care of headlines, because you can tear something up with a headline, like, and we see it on a regular, and it's another one of my pet peeves. And I understand, like a lot of the times it's literally on purpose for the purpose of the clicks. I get that. I do, but certain topics should not be clickbait. Yeah.
Do you think that there's a certain freedom in expressing your thoughts through words?
Absolutely. I know some people, you know, see thoughts and they jumble up for them. Like they never clear up, and it's hard to get out what they actually want to say and what they actually mean. But for me, I love words. I love the sounds of words, the rhythms that they make. I think that's one of my favorite things about being a writer is that, like I say, I wrote poetry, but sometimes when I write, I'm literally writing stories, but I write it with a beat. Things don't always, you know, they don't, I've never written a haiku. I don't know how to write a sonnet. I don't know how to do any of that. I just kind of write to a beat. I hope that means I can be a rapper someday. You know,
hey, so. Bars.
Literally, but yeah, it's, everything makes sense when I'm writing it down. And sometimes it takes a minute, but it almost always makes sense when I see it in words and sentences. Sometimes it's even like the shape of words. Like sometimes I will quite literally like write a poem just for the shape because I want to see it in a triangle, like something like that. Everything just kind of makes sense when it's in a word, it's in a sentence, it's in a prose.
Yeah. We talked about this idea like throughout the interview of like people who don't call themselves activists but are like what they do, even in if it's not like going out in the streets and protesting, but what they're doing within like their job is like activism. What do you think? What do you think the power of being an activist but not really called an activist is? And I guess the second part of that is the title of an activist restricting or liberating?
I think being an activist who doesn't identify as an activist is kind of, to answer the first question with the second question, I think it's liberating to be an activist who doesn't identify as an activist, because I think when you place that word upon it, it does become kind of restricting, but not necessarily with a negative connotation. I think I identify mostly as a writer. And I think when I place the word activist, it means that all my writings are about Black plight or Black experience. I do write primarily about Black experience because that's my experience. That's what I write about. But it's not always Black trauma. It's not always anything trauma related. It's not always anything activist related. Sometimes it's just my experience as a woman, as a sexual human being, as as a nappy haired little girl, you know, like it does kind of place a box around it. And I think I actually struggle with that a little bit. I told you I only wrote one actual poem in 2020 because, you know, people had so much to say, and I was honestly tired of saying anything. Like it was exhausting to see everything, to watch everything, and talking about it. At that point, it didn't make me feel better. It was no longer a relief. And so I think not labeling myself an activist is, I think that has more to do with me not labeling myself. Like I don't try to put myself in a box, period. I hold many titles. I don't mind adding that to the list. It's just not something that, you know, if I saw my name on Wikipedia, I don't want to see one thing behind it. And that doesn't just apply to activism. Like I don't want to just see that I'm a writer. I'm an athlete too. I'm also an activist, you know, like I have a lot to me, period. And yeah, I think again it can be a little restricting just because it places you in a box and it says, this is what she writes about. This is what she's good at writing about. And that's all there is to her. It's not like I write about other things, but yeah.
Yeah. know, that repetition of like Black people, Black women are like single faced or like one dimensional. Mm-hmm. And like, it's really hard to like transcend that because like, mm-hmm. that's what the popular narrative is. Like, and it's activist work to mm-hmm. to like get past that like stereotype in general. But I totally understand what you're saying. I guess my next question is, what would your advice be to younger people who identify as activists or who are doing the work? What would your advice be?
Don't burn yourself out. It's very easy to watch the news every day and to think about things that have happened in your life and to take other people's trauma as your own. And it's very easy to burn yourself out. All of whatever your method is, it's very easy to get to put yourself in a block where you're unable to, you know, create your work because you are quite literally burnt out. You've watched so much trauma that you've taken it on as your own, and there's nothing you can do. Your creative method is no longer an outlet for you because you're putting out all the trauma that you're receiving. Mm. And then I think also be willing to learn. Like I accept 100% that I do not know it all. Sometimes I say the wrong thing, and I'm completely 100% okay with going back and being like, I'm sorry, I was incorrect. Someone taught me. I'm willing to learn from anyone. I don't shy away from conversations with anyone. Because you can learn from everyone, from everything. I think that's probably been the biggest thing for me. And I think that's why, another reason, like, I don't really label myself an activist, because I just feel like looking back at all the activists then, and they just seem like they knew it all, you know, like they just, and I mean, of course, like, I'm sure they didn't, you know, but just looking back at it, you know, like, I feel like I'm still a kid, and I'm just doing what sometimes I think is right. And I don't know if that actually is the right thing. And, you know, I feel like giving me that title places a lot of responsibility on my shoulders. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not to say that I won't accept it. It's just, you know, like, I'm still a human. Like, I'm scared to fail. As much as I know failure is okay, as much as I know failure is just a benchmark, like, I'm still scared to fail in that aspect. So, I mean, you know, don't take it as the end all be all. That title means that you care about your people so much that you put out a part of yourself to stand up for your people, to do what you can to help. And maybe you're talented, like, you know, like, you're talented. So I think, yeah, don't let it be the end all be all. Like, be willing to learn, be open, know that failure is okay, but it's also okay to be scared to fail because it just means you're human.
And last question, where do you see the movement going? Mm-hmm. Or where would you like to see it?
See, this, I feel like this goes back to that. Like, I would not ever know what change would look like. I know I want it, but, you know, I don't think I have any type of utopia in my head. Mm-hmm. I want, you know, specifically, I don't know what would start the change. I don't know, honestly, where to begin. I have what I feel like are logical answers, but I don't actually know. So I think I would just want, I would want a lack of the fear as Black people that we hold, the trauma, the things that we experience that are specific to us because of our history, because of our color. I would want those things I feel like the best word would be to subside. You know, ideally, I don't want anyone to feel those things, but I also understand that, I don't know how to put this like politically correct, but I understand mm-hmm. that what makes Black people so great sometimes is mm-hmm. the magic that comes out of our trauma. Mm-hmm. We do some amazing things in spite of when others are given the platform and the opportunities to do the same things. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that I would want anyone to stay with this trauma, mm-hmm. and that's why I say subside, because I don't want anyone to forget the things that we've been through.
Yeah.
But I do want there to be less of an imminent fear. An imminent understanding. Like I want my children to be educated, but I want them to be so far removed that that's not something they have to experience. Mm-hmm. I want those fears and that trauma to subside in a matter of imminent danger. I want people to understand the things that we went through, the things that Emmett Till went through, the things that all of these names and faces that we've looked up to and that we've learned so much about. I want you to understand, I want you to be educated, but I don't want you to have that same imminent fear that if I look at this man wrong, he's going to pull me over. Mm. He's going to ask me what I'm doing here. He's going to tell me I don't belong here. Or that I have to make sure that I'm not driving this red car too fast because I'm going to get pulled over. And that when I do get pulled over, it's simply because, oh, I want you to be safe because these are the laws, not you're coming with me because you look mm-hmm. like this. So I think for the imminent danger to subside would be the only like, I think the only tangible ideals like I could really think of. And I say that like I use those examples, but I want that to be through everything. Like I want, you know, Black women to have full faith in their doctors when they go to the hospital. You know, like literally, like I want that imminent danger that we deal with every day, the things that we understand and that we go through without a second thought to not to be a first thought, a second thought, like not to exist in our minds outside of we were educated. We understand that that was a thing, but it's no longer a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Again, I don't know how any of that begins to happen.
Yeah.
But yeah.
That's powerful though. That really is. Well, thank you so much for taking some of your time to speak with me today. This interview has been great. Like, I can't wait to transcribe it and just send it into the archive for so many other people to learn from you and to learn from your words and your work. And just thank you so much. Are there any more questions?
No, not really. I mean, you know, if you get a good grade, let me know.
Okay.
Yeah, if there's anything else you need, let me know.
Thank you. You know, Duke is, ooh, it's getting to me, but you know.
Listen, more power to you, girl.
But yeah. Well, thank you so much for being with me again. And if you have any more questions about the interview or just life in general, feel free to email me. And yeah, have a great one. Have a great senior year.
Thank you, honey. You do the same.
Thank you. Have a good one.